At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The global economy picked up today right where it left off on Friday, worried about debt. Banks here and overseas are being shut down or bailed out. Investors can't make heads or tails, but there are some upsides. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with more than 30,000 local independent agents. Information available at progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 24th of May. Great to have you with us. The broadcast today begins with a tale of two banks, one here down in Georgia that we'll get to in just a minute, the other one in Spain, a smallish savings bank called Cajasur. It was bailed out this weekend by the Spanish government to the tune of $750 million. The International Monetary Fund says all the same that Spain is doing okay for now, but it does still need some big reforms, and pronto. The head of the European Commission told Germany its proposals to resolve the debt crisis there are naive. And so, with that as backdrop, we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth for an update on how we're doing.
There's good news and there's bad news. Here's the bad news first. The European debt crisis is making banks nervous. So they're charging each other more to borrow money. That's a problem because banks pass on those costs to businesses who borrow from them. Beth Ambovino is a senior economist at Standard & Poor's, and she says that can have all kinds of effects.
That's going to be weight on their plans to expand, basically their interest in maybe increasing hires, and that will ultimately be a weight on employment for people looking for jobs as well.
Now here's the good news. Europe's problems are making investors nervous, too. They're rushing to buy our treasury bonds, and that's making treasuries cheaper. Bovino points out that's important because a lot of mortgage rates are based on treasuries.
So that, in a sense, has given U.S. rates a little bit of a break. Mortgage rates are down significantly. That does certainly help the housing sector stabilize further.
That's great for people who are closing on houses now and for homeowners who want to refinance. Still, it probably won't have a big effect on the housing market. Tom Higgins is chief economist at Peyton & Riegel. It's an asset management firm in Los Angeles.
So it's significant, but it's not a dramatic impact. Mortgage rates were already low before this crisis. And I think they're going to remain low for the foreseeable future.
But Beth Ambovino from Standard & Poor's says the bad news could still win out. If the sovereign debt crisis in Europe gets worse, it wouldn't take long before it crossed the ocean. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Bank number two in our tale today is Georgia's Satilla Community Bank. It was seized by the FDIC a couple of weeks ago, one of about 75 banks to be shut down by federal regulators this year. Satilla Community is in a town called St. Mary's, Georgia, down in the southeastern corner of a state that has seen more bank failures than any other the past 2 years. Dozens of small banks in the Peach State turn out to have something very rotten at the core, as Jeff Horwich reports.
Georgia's dubious number one status is the story of a down-home banking system swept up by big city dreams. Traditionally, Georgia has had lots of small banks, a legacy of laws meant to keep banks focused on their local customers. But during the boom, when development took off next door in Florida, small banks saw an opportunity to make a lot of money. Bert Ely is a banking consultant. He says the banks tapped into a stream of billions in so-called broker deposits that flowed in from out of state looking for high interest rates.
A number of these failed banks did use broker deposits to fuel excessively rapid growth in high-risk lending, oftentimes in markets where they didn't understand the lending risk.
Ely says the banks competed to see who could be most generous, both with deposits and loans. Atlanta-based banking attorney Walt Mayling says state examiners might have spotted the risk if there'd been more of them. He points to one practice regulators didn't police, where banks created reserves to cover borrowers' interest payments, but never funded them.
It wasn't reflected in the bank's data furnished to the regulators, and you could only have seen that by being on site.
Loans failed, depositors pulled out, and 39 small banks have shut down in Georgia since 2007. And the number of bank examiners in Georgia is shrinking. The state doesn't pay for those inspectors. The banks do. But Mayling says lawmakers directed half the money that was supposed to pay for regulation to balance the state budget.
You not only don't get your money's worth, you have a hidden tax on banks.
The examiner's office may be short-staffed, but that doesn't mean it's not hustling. The Georgia Bankers Association says its members are reporting lots of in-person visits from the watchdogs these days. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Okay, so off banks now onto healthcare. Any doctor who's been in practice more than a couple of years has probably been wined and dined by a sales rep from a big pharmaceutical company, or maybe invited to speak at a conference at some fabulous getaway, all expenses paid. The freebies were supposed to boost sales. Those days are gone, so all the drug reps can do now is pitch their products. The FDA is watching, but it needs some help, thanks to a tip line where doctors can report misleading pitches. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Drug companies get the word out about their products in different ways, through TV ads, with the announcer speed-reading the side effects at the end. But they spend much more marketing medications directly to doctors, and those marketing claims are hard to police. So the FDA is deputizing doctors.
We are against misleading advertising, and there are circumstances where it does happen. That's kind of why we have jobs.
That's Mike Sowers. His job is consumer safety officer at the FDA. Before that, he worked for Pfizer. He was a sales rep for the pharmaceutical giant, so he knows the rules for marketing pitches.
It must be accurate. It must balance the risk and benefit information and only include information that is supported by strong evidence from clinical studies.
The FDA set up the tip line earlier this month. So far, it's gotten about 70 email complaints. Dr. Rebecca Patchen heads the American Medical Association.
Many times the pharmaceutical representative can provide information. At other times, you have to be aware that there is the incentive to sell a product.
Drug companies say the FDA's willingness to accept anonymous complaints isn't fair. Peter Pitts is a former FDA associate commissioner who now does marketing for drug companies.
I think anonymous tips lead you down the wrong direction of people using these types of things for their own purposes rather than to advance the public health.
The FDA says it prefers tipsters who identify themselves. It's also asking for evidence, like promotional materials a doctor found misleading. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, yeah, that was another fade at the finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama has dispatched a pair of cabinet officials back to the Gulf Coast. Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano and Interior Secretary Ken Salazar have been touring parts of Louisiana today. This is day 35 of the spill, if you're keeping count, and most people down on the Gulf Coast are. For almost all of them, this spill could not have happened at a worse time. We are in the middle of fishing rodeo season, as it happens. No bull riding, just fishing for speckled trout, maybe some redfish, and hopefully cash and trophies. Some of the rodeos have been canceled due to the slick, including the annual International Women's Fishing Rodeo in Venice, Louisiana, down south of New Orleans. Today was supposed to be their first day on the water. Susan Groh has been involved in that tournament since it started back in 2003. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai. Thank you for calling us.
Now, there are some rodeos up and down the coast there that are still going on. I guess it kind of depends on where you are in relation to the oil spill.
I would say so. A lot of them are on hold. Some have been pushed out further. Maybe a tournament that might have taken place in May may be scheduled for August. But that's going to all be dependent on what happens, you know, in the next couple of weeks here.
Mm-hmm. What does it look like is going to happen, Ms. Groh?
It's not looking good, Kai. We of course, are on the front lines here in Venice. The oil spill is south of us. And unfortunately, the dispersants that they introduced at 5,000 feet have thrown us a whammy. We're not able to fight the oil on the surface as we had planned. It's rolling in underneath, and it is in our wetlands, unfortunately.
Have you and your boats been participating in any of the cleanup or boom operations that are going on out there?
There are several of the captains that are participating in the BP Vessel of Opportunity program. However, there's still a little bit of organization and direction that needs to take place there.
On BP's part or on y'all's?
Actually, it's about time for the government to take over this ball.
Oh, you think so?
And start directing it, yes.
What would you like to see happen? I mean, there's been a lot of controversy about that the past couple of days.
I think there's just direction coming from too many directions, Kai, if you will. I mean, you've got Coast Guard on the side, you've got a commandant that's running everything and supposedly keeping the boot on the neck of BP, as they put it on the media. But simple things, you know, let's take it back a step. Let's build that barrier island back like it used to be, and we can pick the oil up off of the beach. We cannot pick it up from a lacework of interior marsh. It's going to be there forever until the marsh dies.
Mm-hmm. And down in Venice and down south of you, you don't have any beaches. It's all that marsh.
We don't have any beaches. They keep talking about the beaches. This is the Cajun Riviera. We have marsh, and it's very fertile, and it's our nurseries and our estuaries. And if we kill it, everything else is going to go with it.
How bad is business for you these days?
It's zero.
How long can you make it, then, as an owner of a fishing adventure company, if you can't fish?
Not very long, unless I go and get a different job for a while. And that's going to be tough in the type of economy that we have to deal with, Kai. That's our other thing that we're facing.
Yeah, and I imagine many of your colleagues are in the same situation.
They're in the same boat, not to use.
I was going to say that, but then I figured that would be really bad.
We're on the same boat here. Yeah. And it's got a little hole in it. We've got our finger in it. We've got it plugged right now, and we're going to try to keep it afloat because I will take this time to, you know, cheerlead for Venice, Louisiana. It is one of the world's greatest fishing destinations.
Susan Groh of Real Louisiana Adventures down in Venice, Louisiana. Ms. Groh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Here's a thought to sober up all those college graduation parties. Students who did manage to cross the academic finish line are about to come face-to-face with the cost of the education they just completed. The first student loan bills are going to start showing up in about 6 months, and that'll surely spark a new round of questions about whether or not college is worth it. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Amy Scott reports.
Everybody's in number order.
In a hallway in the music building at Purchase College in New York, seniors in black gowns line up by major. In a few hours, they'll graduate in front of their parents and friends. Some have started celebrating early. You can smell it on their breath. They'll have to get serious soon enough.
I'm pretty concerned right now. It's kind of scary just coming out of college, you know. It's a lot of pressure to find jobs, and it's kind of hard.
Environmental studies major Robert Shaw worries about finding work. Others are tallying how much they owe.
All in all, I think it costs maybe $35,000. I think most of it is in loans.
$26,030.
A good $14,000, not bad.
Purchase is a public college, part of the State University of New York. At $4,900 a year, the in-state tuition is at the low end of the spectrum. But 7 years ago, it was just $3,400. Students like Maria Griffo wonder if they got their money's worth.
If I knew exactly what I wanted to go to college for right when I was jumping in and committing to that much money, it would have been worth it.
But Griffo didn't really know what she wanted to do when she started at Purchase. She majored in film studies and then realized she wanted to be a teacher.
I learned so much about, you know, the history of film and, like, cinematography, and it was wonderful, but not very useful, not for 35 grand. Like, I could find that out online.
In the last few decades, the sticker price of college has risen faster than just about everything else we buy, even healthcare. There are lots of reasons. Cuts in state funding, expensive health benefits for faculty and staff. Anya Kamenetz writes about the cost of higher education and student debt. She says schools are under pressure to build fancier dorms and fitness centers to compete for students.
As much as parents might marvel at these kinds of, you know, extravagances of the climbing walls in the gyms or the free electronics giveaways to freshmen or, you know, high-speed Wi-Fi in every dorm, college presidents tell me that this is something that families are demanding.
Kamenetz says tuition is rising for a couple other reasons, too. The easy flow of student loans helps mask the cost, and families still think college is the key to success for their kids. Studies have shown you earn a lot more if you go to college.
Over a lifetime, assuming you manage to get the degree, on average, it's still a good deal. And as long as people can say that, you know, they can justify almost any price.
But we may be reaching a turning point. Economist Richard Vedder directs the Center for College Affordability and Productivity.
In our zeal to get everyone a college education, we're finding more and more people going out with a bachelor's degree that are having a hard time getting a job that fits the skills that they believe that they picked up in college. And maybe the notion that everyone should go to college is one that we need to rethink in light of this labor market experience.
Of course, finding a high-paying career isn't the only reason people go to college. At the Purchase College graduation, some of the other reasons are on display, on the beaming faces of parents and students like DeLorean Briggs. He worked two jobs and took out loans to put himself through school.
I think the experience itself was like the best experience that I could possibly have. I'm actually happy that I came here. It just feels good to be leaving now.
Graduate Kevin Higgins had 17 years to try out adult life without a college degree. He decided to go back to school after being laid off from his job in retail.
If I had just continued going down the path that I was going, there was always a ceiling that I'd hit as far as salary and all that. So I didn't want to do retail for the rest of my life. So for me, this is just more of a, not even so much the money, but just moving on to do something that I wanted to do for a long time.
Higgins wants to become a teacher. Next, he plans to get a master's degree. In Purchase, New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For all those grads thinking about finding their fortunes on Wall Street, not so fast. What high finance is really worth for students after college and for the rest of us, tomorrow on the program. Coming up, Britain's upper crust back in charge.
I resent deeply the fact that I'm now ruled by a cabinet largely made up of that 2% of the population that actually can go to private school. I hate it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street just can't shake its worries over Europe. I'd say the Dow Industrials dropped 126 points, nearly 1.25%, ended at 10,066. The Nasdaq trimmed 15 points, lost nearly 0.7%, finished at 2,213. The S&P 500 shaved 14 points, a loss of more than 1%, closed at 1,073. Financial shares dragged the market down. Morgan Stanley unloaded 5%. Bank of America and J.P. Morgan both slid more than 3.5%. Goldman Sachs down nearly 3% today. Tech stocks fared slightly better. Analysts recommended investors take a bigger bite of Apple. That sent its shares up nearly 2%. Google added about 1%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.21%. Can you say safe haven, anybody? You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases its monthly Consumer Confidence Index. The Senate Finance Committee looks at increasing quality in the unemployment system. And if you're counting calories, you'll have to count pretty high for this one. The Center for Science and the Public Interest hands out its Extreme Eating Awards. They aren't good. Winners include some of the unhealthiest items on menus in U.S. restaurants. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You know, if there is one catchphrase for the financial crisis of the past couple of years, one thing that when you say it, everybody knows what you're talking about, I'd say it's probably too big to fail. Commentator and economist Glenn Hubbard says the reform bill by Senator Christopher Dodd that passed last week doesn't do enough about TBTF.
If we're serious about financial reform, then we should be worried about the Dodd bill. In particular, it seems to forget that too big to fail is the elephant in the room and must be fixed. The bill does nothing to get at too big to fail. In fact, it makes the problem worse in what it would do and who it would help. First, the what. The bill grants Washington too much discretion to bail out financial giants. It no longer contains a literal bailout fund, thanks to GOP opposition. But the proposed law would still allow Uncle Sam to bail out even quite sophisticated institutional creditors of investment banks, who should be taking responsibility for judging which risks to take. Just as bad, it would permit government officials to play favorites among creditors, as the Obama administration did in its bailout of automakers. The Dodd bill doesn't just expand bailout possibilities, it embraces them. It would retain Washington's power to make broad loan guarantees, and the Fed would be able to continue to accept dodgy assets as collateral for the loans it makes. The result? The scaffolding for a permanent bailout authority. This is costly in taxpayer dollars and lost accountability. The ability to act in a crisis is important, but can be accomplished in other ways. Now the who. Who is too big to fail? The legislation would label some financial institutions as systemically important to be regulated by the Fed. This is a mistake. Once we identify an institution as too big to fail, it becomes more likely it will be bailed out. Investors know any money they put into it will be protected, and that would channel funds toward risky investments in financial giants, and it could discourage investment in smaller financial institutions. We can do better than this. And we must if we want to limit bailout nation enthusiasm in Washington. Memo to President Obama. Please ask congressional leaders for more than a subprime bill.
Glenn Hubbard ran the Council of Economic Advisors for President George W. Bush. He's now the dean of the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. Your comments are always welcome. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on that link that says Contact. Britain's new coalition government announced $9 billion worth of budget cuts today. It's just the first of what promises to be a series of announcements this year aimed at getting the UK's red ink under control. Austerity budgets are no fun anywhere, much less in a country where class differences aren't far from the surface. And for the first time in almost 50 years, the British government is dominated by members of the social and economic upper crust, toughs, as the Brits like to say. From London Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The new government is planning, among other things, radical change in the UK's constitution. The Deputy Prime Minister is Nick Clegg.
I'm talking about the biggest shake-up of our democracy since the great reforms of the 19th century.
If all goes to plan, Parliament will be transformed, the voting system and party funding overhauled. Practically a revolution, claims Prime Minister David Cameron.
It can be a historic and seismic shift in our political landscape.
The Queen
commands this Honourable House to attend upon Her Majesty immediately in the House of Peers.
But the new leaders don't seem, on the face of it, like revolutionary material. Cameron is a direct descendant of King William IV. Clegg is the grandson of a Russian baroness. The new finance chief is a member of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy. Dennis Skinner is a proudly working-class member of Parliament.
It really is incredible that they're claiming to be the party of change.
Skinner represents the town of Bolsover. He was dubbed the Beast of Bolsover for his savage parliamentary attacks on the wealthy and privileged. He's not impressed with the Blue Bloods now in power.
Their ideas have all emanated from the class with which they're associated, and it looks like they're going to hit the working class really hard.
Lord Elderly, Lord Boromir, Lord Sickert, and Lord Camp.
Of course, Britain has changed enormously since Noel Coward gently lampooned the ruling classes in the 1930s. Over the past 50 years, most prime ministers have had humble origins. Margaret Thatcher was the daughter of a shopkeeper, John Major the son of a circus performer. So finding toffs like Cameron and Clegg at the pinnacle of British politics is highly unusual today. Economist Andrew Hilton is also unhappy about it.
I resent deeply the fact that I'm now ruled by a cabinet largely made up of that 2% of the population that actually can go to private school. I hate it.
A FBN, A Eddie Oak, Simon Ann.
If he had fled, we would have
followed.
In other words, what time does it refer to?
A class in ancient Greek, an exclusive private school called Westminster. This school gave Nick Clegg one of the best educations money can buy. Cameron went to Eton. Both Clegg and Cameron went on to elite universities and then into comfortable jobs in PR and lobbying. Dennis Skinner believes they have little or no empathy with the poorest and most disadvantaged, those who could suffer the most from the public spending cuts.
Once they start cutting expenditure here, left, right and centre, they're going to eat into those benefits that assist those at the bottom of the pile.
Class warriors like Dennis Skinner, it must be said, are increasingly rare. After all, almost 60% of the electorate voted for Cameron and Clegg's respective parties. On the street, most people say they don't care about the new leader's pedigree.
I was in the army for 22 years. I'm used to working with officers from the upper class, so, you know, it doesn't bother me at all.
It's modern Britain. Yes, they are from a privileged elite, from a minority, but I think we just need to judge as we find, wait and see.
But Britain's old obsession with class could re-emerge if the new government's reforming zeal falters and if the public spending cuts really begin to bite. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the National Football League lost one in the Supreme Court this morning. The case was all about licensing the sales of hats and jerseys and other assorted team paraphernalia. The justices said the NFL's 32 teams are, in fact, separate businesses and that the league has no antitrust right to negotiate as a single entity with companies that make those hats and jerseys. Net effect? Some competition in the apparel business for companies that make pro football and basketball and hockey stuff. Baseball? Not so much. Baseball still has a congressionally authorized antitrust exemption. For now, anyway. And for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 126 points, nearly 1.25%. The Nasdaq shaved off 15.6%. The S&P 500 shed 14 points. That is more than 1%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, why some of the best and brightest from Harvard and beyond are still headed to Wall Street.
I like to believe that money didn't have a lot to do with it, but the paycheck you can't get away from. You need to eat, you need to live somewhere, and a lot of times being in an exciting place like Boston or New York is expensive.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.